What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where I'm joined by Ryan McLeod, the man, the myth, the legend, also known as Nuclear Bitcoiner. We talk all about the energy grid, nuclear power, and much, much more. So be sure to tune in for another action-packed episode. And as always, ladies and gentlemen, this is not financial advice. Everything you hear in this podcast should not be taken as financial advice. And big shout out to Pleb Lab. I'm actually down in Austin as we speak right now for a bachelor party, but I might take a stop by Pleb Lab, the hacking co-working space, hack center. I don't even know what to call it at this point, but it's an amazing spot where a bunch of Bitcoiners are living, not really, but kind of, because they work so much and they're working to keep everything on the Bitcoin network strong and healthy, whether it's developing Lightning or much, much more. So be sure to tune in and join anything that they got going on. I mean, they have a bunch of events, Nostr Devs, a bunch of different stuff. Nifty is putting on another dev course, so be sure to get in on that action. All right, enough for me. Hit that subscribe button, give me the 5-star rating, and tune in for another episode.
What's up, everybody? I'm back with another edition of the State of Bitcoin podcast, where we got Ryan McLeod here with us, the Nuclear Bitcoiner. So I'll start it off right off the bat, Ryan. It seems like the trend towards nuclear is almost an inevitability at this point. There has been a lot of political tension. There has been a lot of politics, you know, kind of being thrown around there to avoid nuclear. But it seems like the tide is changing. So tell us, where do you think nuclear kind of is in overall, like, just the, in general, the energy landscape when it comes to, you know, using it for power?
Yeah, like, nuclear power has been recognized as a reliable baseload energy source for at least 70-ish years now, since the first demonstration power reactors came online in that era. Since then, we've got very good at building this technology and upgrading it with each sequential generation of deployments. There's been definitely some stops and starts over the years, and there's been a significant activism movement against nuclear power for the reasons that they have, whether it is genuine or ignorance or just outright malice against the technology in preference to another technology. That's everyone's decision at this point to support, but it is starting to be recognized pretty much around the world by populations and policymakers and industrial leaders that nuclear power is going to play a significant role in the energy transition as we gradually displace our usage of hydrocarbons for power and heat generation sources, and possibly even transportation in some venues. Like, nuclear power, it'll be a long time before we ever see a nuclear powered car or automobile or like aeroplane on the markets, but shipping freighters is one that is attainable and reasonable and does contribute a lot to the hydrocarbon usage globally. So we can displace them a lot from those avenues, and by being able to do so, we can displace them not completely out of usage, but to more higher order usages, like making more sophisticated chemicals with hydrogen and methane, making fertilizer, doing metal refining and smelting operations use these chemicals like methane and hydrogen as their feedstock. So we can be using nuclear power as the main power and heat source to create these chemicals that then can be used to displace typically what we use ground extracted fossil fuels and hydrocarbons for. So we're seeing a lot of interest in nuclear power to do that, but there's still a lot of fighting because there is a large movement to move towards wind and solar, but anybody that advocates for wind and solar sees any investment going towards nuclear power as investment that's not going towards their preferred technology. And there's lots of arguments as to whether or not we can perform 100% wind and solar, hydro and battery grid, which is debatable. And some people believe it's possible. Some people believe that is a lot of hopium. And the same people that are putting their stake on those pathways claim that investing and putting our time and energy into small modular reactors is a misguided pathway, that we should be directing that more towards all of these, the renewable side of things. So it's a very push and pull right now between all of these vested interests and who is telling a better story to get policymakers to lean in towards their favor and ultimately get a better seat at the subsidy trough, which I would like to see these technologies compete more on their merit, more so than on who can tell a better story to policymakers and get more money out of those decision makers.
So, yeah, I mean, it seems like I've said, and like you're lining out, right? There's a movement towards nuclear energy, and it seems almost like a no-brainer. And, you know, it is also, quote-unquote, green energy as well. So why do you think that there's been such a push for wind and solar and, you know, these other kinds of, I guess, like ESG movements? Like, why is it because of, you know, where the money is kind of going? I mean, it seems like if you kind of follow that trail, that's where it seems like it is. Because to me, but you know, I'd love to hear your opinion as somebody who's, you know, working in that industry on the day-to-day basis as to why, you know, the ESG movement has gotten to the point where it is.
I think it's a lot. It just becomes to framing the narrative. They've been telling the story that in order to stave off an impending climate-related like doomsday scenario, we must eradicate our usage of hydrocarbons as fast as possible, and the only technologies that we can build fast enough to do so is wind and solar, which in some regards, like, yes, we can build them fast, but then there's other trade-offs that you get into with grid interconnectivity, which causes many delays in them. And then so their main argument is that climate change is such an imperative problem that we need to be solving as fast as possible. It puts you into the mindset where you're going to be kind of shooing aside the technologies that may take time and require a lower time preference to build out and invest in favor of these much faster to deploy, but not as clearly like defined trade-offs as we have using technologies that we're familiar with, at least like transitioning to small modular reactors from big nuclear reactors. Like, we're familiar with nuclear technology. We're just going to move it into smaller markets. By completely changing our grid system to run off of like weather dependent sources, especially when we're going to be expecting dramatic changes in the weather, seems to be a strange pathway to take to begin with. And I was also reading yesterday, what was his name? Stefan Kvist. And I think he was one of the CEOs of the UAE power generation company. They put out a report describing inertia on the grids and how important that is, that we have generators that have a spinning component to them. So all their thermal generators that require a turbine to spin. So that's our natural gas, our coal plants, our nuclear plants, and the hydro plants. They all have this inertia associated with them that helps them maintain grid frequency. And then the more inertia we have available on the grid, the less disruptive major power droppages we'll have on the wider system. So like if we did lose a large generator, by having this inertia distributed across a lot more of these sources, it's able to withstand that sudden drop. But if we are to have completely like inverter-based and like windmill-based that aren't synchronized with that frequency of the grid, when we lose them, it has a much different effect on how the grid reacts. So like if you think about it like a bathtub where the water is flowing in is the generation and then the water flowing out is the consumption load, the width of the tub is the inertia. So the wider the tub, if there's a change in rate of the flow out of the tub or into the tub, because it's wider, it does not change as much. The level in the tub will only change a small amount. But with less inertia, the tub is thinner. So if there's a significant change in the consumption pattern, load pattern that outpaces the generation, then it can have significant disruptions to the grid and fall outside of that very narrow frequency band that they like to operate within. And there's lots of strategies that they're proposing to mitigate this, but a lot of it is either only been tested in very small scale scenarios, like hyper-localized situations, or it's just in theory, this is how it could work, which is just as much hopium as we're putting on a lot of these like microgrid SMR scenarios. But at least we know once we have a solid generator, we have all of these inertial capabilities and just baseload power requirements that will be available. And with the large power generators, just we know it's 24/7 baseload. We don't need firming up and backing up to support them. So it's seems like it's just become a matter of like they've pitched this idea that we have to move so fast that we have to use these technologies that we can install now. But now the trade-off that we're starting to see is as we're installing more of it, it is adding a lot more complexity to the grids in actually delivering that electricity to the consumers, and these unforeseen consequences like really reducing the amount of inertia that it's available on the grid, causing potential disruptions if we do have any disruptions anywhere along the generation sources on the grid.
Yeah, and I mean, it, like you said, it seems like it's, you know, very difficult to try to implement, and it seems like there's been a very heavy push towards these ESG movements. But obviously, you know, nuclear has been around for some time, and it seems like that's kind of has like, I guess, a negative connotation around it. Obviously, you know, we've seen a little bit more headway towards that, I guess, the nuclear power and kind of starting to develop that. So as far as like, I guess, the overall general narrative of nuclear, like, are you seeing, I guess, a little bit more of a shift when it comes to, I guess, you know, the overall vibe, so to speak, of nuclear? Like, is it as much of, I guess, a beneficial kind of topic opposed to, you know, nuclear sort of bad and then just pointing to, you know, prior catastrophes and kind of, you know, ignorance in that sense?
Yeah, the technology definitely has a legacy that people are familiar with. And that is one of the problems with it, is that when nuclear power is working as it should, it's actually quite boring and people don't ask questions. When the lights turn on, everyone just goes about their day and they don't really start asking where their power comes from until you start having situations where you're being requested by your local power provider to curtail your usage during certain times of the day. And like right now, in many places in America, there's voluntary programs that are starting to roll out, where there's like parts of the world where it's involuntary and you don't know exactly when or for how long that power is going to be out. In places that used to have robust, reliable grids, like South Africa, like Lebanon, like these places used to have reliable grids. And now we hear stories all the times that people are dependent on having generators to back up their power just because they don't know when they're not going to have it available to them. And they have to plan their lives accordingly around this new level of unpredictability with their power systems. And so people that are starting to see these scenarios more and more are seeing the value of having nuclear power in their mix. There's also a lot of people paying attention to what's happening in Germany and how their grid has shifted significantly. Like, I would say late 21 was a significant turning point for nuclear power, because that was like it was before the events with Russia and Ukraine had kind of kicked off, but we were starting to see a much more interdependency amongst like allies and adversaries for their energy systems. Like, most of Europe had become dependent upon Russia for a lot of its natural gas fuel, and a lot of the world was dependent on Russia for uranium enrichment as well. So that's become an interesting puzzle piece that the nuclear industry is trying to fit back together, as because America had diminished its enrichment capabilities over the last several decades, and so Russia had been supporting the primary, like most of the global market on that front. So now there's a shift to try and rejuvenate our fuel pathways and enrichment capabilities in North America. And then on top of that, it's just many of these countries are just seeing that they do not want to be dependent upon anybody. Like, Poland is a good example right now. They've made it clear that they want to develop a lot of nuclear power. They've been in talks with Westinghouse. They've been in talks with the Korean Energy Company. They've been in talks with some of the SMR vendors. Like, they are going to apply the whole gambit of technologies that are available to build a robust nuclear energy infrastructure in their country that they will even be able to export to their neighbors. Another one that was recently came up, Canada just announced that they're going to finance the construction of two CANDU reactors in Romania, which was something that was discussed shortly after they had finished the first two CANDU reactors in Romania, that they were going to build a 3 and 4. And as far as I know, they had started preparing the sites and then they just ran out of financing. So those have just been hanging in limbo until just last week when they finally got this announcement they would receive money to build them. Like just throughout Canada, like Ontario has plans to expand our Bruce generating station and our Darlington generating station with SMRs. They want to, the first one that they want to build, is to use something that we're familiar with. Like the technology is going to be just a smaller version of a boiled water reactor at 300 megawatts. And then that's going to be basically built in a serialized modular fashion where there's already, I would say, at least customers lined up for at least 30 of these units within probably by 2040 and probably growing. Like Saskatchewan just announced that they want 6 of them. Alberta's announced that they want at least 4 of these. Like Poland's on the list for them. I think like Estonia and Lithuania, a few Eastern European countries are looking at this size of reactor because it's a good size to fit into a mid-sized market that's not appropriate for a large gigawatt-sized reactor, but still wants to have access to a reliable like nuclear power source that can displace a lot of their hydrocarbon generation sources, especially places that are using coal and want to transition off of coal. Switching out a coal plant with a nuclear power plant is a much more feasible operation than doing so with windmills and solar panels, mostly because of the land use that you're going to have. You can basically put a small nuclear reactor on the footprint of the old coal plant and use the existing transmission infrastructure and then use that as a means to save on a lot of the capital costs of building this. Because one of the things, when you start building power infrastructure further and further afield, you start needing to build transmission infrastructure further and further afield. And then the more of this you have going on simultaneously, you start getting bottlenecks all throughout these supply chains. Like we're starting to see what was like a 6 month to 1 year lead time to get a transformer is now stretching up into almost like 18 months to 3 years in some cases. So it's putting a lot of strain on these power projects that were proposed and planned years ago, but now are, even though they're built, they can't bring their power to the markets because they don't have all of the pieces of the puzzle required to deliver that electricity to the market. So we're starting to see like diminishing returns as we start building out more and more of the wind and solar infrastructure. So we're starting to see like that we need to have a much wider array of technologies that are contributing to our grids, and so that we aren't dependent on any single source. Like as much as I love nuclear and I want to see like nuclear doing like predominant amount of the job, like even pushing up over 50% would start to be like pushing against like limits where it may not be economically feasible, and it would be better to have trade-offs with different technologies, because we're going to have lots of hydro, we're going to have lots of geothermal, and who knows, like we may start seeing more developments with Nate Harmon and the ocean thermal energy conversion that he's working on down in Hawaii. Like there's a lot of promising technologies out there that I want to see them all give the opportunity to prove what they're capable of, so that, and let the market decide rather than have a lot of this like political picky choosy thing and based on these ESG criteria that are mostly just like made up so that they can pick their preferred technologies. Like it is bizarre when you start seeing that Tesla has a lower ESG score than cigarette companies, and it starts you down that rabbit hole of just like, well, what are these scores even? And it's just another scheme to funnel money towards companies that benefit from the Cantillon effect, basically.
Yeah, I mean, you definitely dove into a lot there. So, I mean, it's hard to unpack. But, you know, you mentioned Canada kind of being at, developing a lot of these nuclear plants and kind of, being towards the forefront of, you know, development. So I guess I have two questions for you. Like, what country is leading the way in nuclear development? And what, I guess maybe even if it's a region, country, or another project, I know you talked about like ocean thermal energy and other things like that, like, you know, where do you kind of see, the development of, you know, some of these more unique sources of energy, whether it's, like the ocean thermal that you described, like where are some areas of the world that you think that are going to be kind of at the forefront when it comes to this revolutionary technology when it comes to, utilizing some of the energies of that region?
Well, I definitely see like the OTAC stuff working really effectively in the equator region, because that's when you're going to get the most like thermal efficiency out of the operation based on the temperature differentials at the equator. The better, the higher temperatures, the better you're going to be able to operate a technology that requires temperature differentials to operate. So they're going to support a lot of equatorial regions once that technology is developed. And it sounds promising, and I'd like to see it in large operation. And like when we do start seeing things actually, I've been hearing some of the Free Cities guys have been talking about seasteading a lot more lately. And like that would actually be an interesting collaborative technology to power like seasteading communes, to have the ability to just use the thermal convectivity of the ocean to power themselves, and then support some Bitcoin miners and whatever other industrial operations they're doing, whether they're extracting minerals from the bottom of the ocean or doing desalination operations. There's any number of things that can be done out on the ocean that in regards to industrial applications, we just haven't had the opportunity to explore yet because we don't have the ability to get an abundant amount of energy out there. So I think once we see that technologies like that really start to flourish and mature, we'll start seeing a lot more applications for it industrial wise that apply to that, to more open ocean in the equatorial region. And then they'll also be like really beneficial to coastal regions where they require like a vast power source that wouldn't require a lot of transmission to connect them to their local grids. And that's another thing that when talking about nuclear freighters that they want to do, is that they'll be able to just pull up to a local port and in theory plug in and be able to provide that power to a local grid. Or as we're into Bitcoin, like we can just plug in a shipping container full of miners, and when it's not being used for transportation, it can just be alternately being diverted to creating hash rate, and with whatever efficiency of machines you use to kind of match whatever your uptime would be for those machines. Like there's a number of different ways to play it, but like those would be good for like coastal regions and equatorial regions. But then like as far as countries leading the way on nuclear power, like South Korea just did an amazing job collaborating with the United Arab Emirates, finishing that set of four reactors at the Baraka site. They've got their sights set on several of their customers that want to build new modules of that reactor. Japan is actively restarting their reactor fleet right now, with plans to build more in the future. Like they went through a period of time where they didn't have their large nuclear reactor fleet, and they were importing a lot of natural gas, a lot of coal, and it became very expensive to keep the lights on and keep the heat on in Japan for the last decade. And it started to put a lot of pressure on their aging demographics, which is, it's not good when you get put in a position to have to choose between heating your home, paying your mortgage, and buying food. So there's too many people in the world getting put into that situation these days that weren't in that situation even just like a few years to a decade ago. So Japan is gung-ho to get their fleet back on. They have the capabilities. They have the entire supply chain for fuel. They only just don't mine the fuel. But once they have the fuel, they can refine the fuel. They can enrich the fuel. They can prepare it for their fuel bundles. They build and design their own reactors. They're quite capable in the industry. Like France is another big leader in the industry. They're also, it was a French company that just finished the reactor in Norway. So that was another good milestone for them. So there's other potential customers looking at the EDF design that they have. EDF is the company, the EPR is the reactor design. Then like Russia still has a good, robust nuclear industry. Rosatom makes a good reactor. They've got several customers. I think Hungary just finished pouring the concrete for two of their reactor sites that they're building with Rosatom. I think Bangladesh just hit a milestone in one of their reactor construction projects that they're doing in collaboration with Russia. I think South Africa is talking with Russia and a few of the other African countries that are interested in nuclear power are also talking with Russia. Like India is another one that's huge into nuclear power that most people don't really hear about because they kind of keep on the down low about it. Like they built a CANDU reactor several decades ago, and then they just kind of built their own design similar to it, and they've been building them pretty steady for the last like 3-4 decades. And at the current rate, I think they're scheduled to almost have like two new reactors constructed every year for like the next 7 or 8 years. So they're on a huge pace. Like China as well is a huge new leader in nuclear technology. They've been building at least one or two reactors a year for the last few years with no end in sight. They're starting to sample into the small modular reactor market and trying out some smaller designs that they can possibly export to the global market. They're in talks with with Saudi Arabia. Yeah, that's who China's in talks with, because Saudi Arabia is an interesting case because they've wanted nuclear power for some time, but because of the fuel handling and export limitations and restrictions that America has kind of imposed on the global nuclear industry, it's made it difficult for Saudi Arabia to get the technology because they wanted more in-house control over their fuel and their fuel refining and enrichment. So they were basically denied the technology by the United States for many years. So now they're looking at China as a possible partner to develop their nuclear infrastructure. And then there's also, because of the successful build in the UAE, UAE is already planning on building two more of those reactors, and many of their neighboring countries have their sights set on possibly doing the same. So there's a lot of interest within like Oman, Jordan, Bahrain. They're all looking at their neighbor in the UAE and thinking that they could do something very similar, because especially the desalination capabilities that nuclear reactors have by providing good high quality steam and heat aside from just electricity. So there's many different, like even the big ones can apply to different markets depending on what part of the world they're in and what the local needs are. So there's a lot of promise on the nuclear power front. And then, yeah, I didn't even mention Canada because, well, I mentioned Canada earlier. Canada and America, like we're going to be trying to build CANDU reactors, and we're like in the U.S., they just finished the Vogtle reactor. So that was a good milestone for the Westinghouse AP1000. So they're hoping to just stamp out more of those. And Poland is one of the customers that's looking at building probably the next one. And really getting into the SMR game. There's, I think, globally, there's 70 different types of small modular reactors being proposed. So not all of them are going to get to the market because they're kind of going to get broken into smaller categories with the very, very small reactors, and then the mid-sized, and then the larger ones of the small category. And then as more and more reach maturity, we'll start to see which ones will fit into each category. And for the global market, there will probably only be maximum 2 to 3 in each category. So that'll limit the field to maybe 12 to 15 altogether. And the hope is that we can get them there while also having like a robust like customer market ready and waiting for them, because it's a very chicken and egg thing. Like we have to prove the reactor capabilities so that we can get fully complete the licensing of these new reactors. But then we also have to ensure that we have customers that are interested in buying them, like before we even really start going through the licensing and early preliminary engineering processes, because like what's the point of going through all that capital expenditure if you don't have customers at the back end to buy them? So everyone's trying to make sure that the customers are there, that the policy is there, that the licensing and regulation is there, and that we can move this forward. So because everyone's kind of got to move in like synchronicity with each other, it's going to feel very slow for the next few years until we start getting the first few reactors demonstrated in 27, 28. And then once we get to that point, then we can have a more modernized like licensing regime to support this new type of reactor, because they're going to use different coolants. They're going to be in different sizes. They're going to apply to different markets. They're going to be going in many different environments and geographies. So there's going we need to get a lot of that streamlined so that we can deploy them as rapidly as possible once they're available. Because if we are as serious as we claim to be about dealing with the effects of climate change, then we need to get these going as fast as possible. And like whether or not we believe that it's going to be apocalyptic or just slightly inconvenient, my pitch is that we should be making ourselves more resilient against whatever may happen, not making ourselves more dependent upon weather that we expect to get quite crazy. So it's yeah, it's overcoming a chicken and egg problem, and then we'll be on off to the races.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And it seems like, you know, you mentioned Saudi Arabia and China kind of like teaming up. And, you know, obviously those are two of the BRICS countries. Do you see that being as kind of, I guess, BRICS almost being at the forefront? Because, you know, from where I'm sitting here right now, it seems like it's almost like a lot of geopolitical tension is going on, right? The U.S. is string that they're pulling is more of the monetary policy, right? The Fed raising interest rate, kind of killing the offshore dollar market. Whereas like the BRICS countries, what they're pulling is on the energy side of things. So it seems like they've kind of had this in their back pocket for a while. So is that kind of, I guess, how you see this almost playing out, so to speak?
Yeah, I would agree that the BRICS nations definitely have an advantage. They've got a lot more like political backing and more alignment with their industry to push these agendas forward. So there's a lot less of like the weird tension where like sometimes in Canada, like, or Sweden and South Korea are two actually perfect examples, because their last elected leaders were anti-nuclear and now they were just voted out. And now Sweden has a pro-nuclear president and so does South Korea, that they scrapped all of the anti-nuclear policies that had been put in by their predecessors and just immediately were like, we're going back nuclear as hard and fast as possible. So that is an interesting development on that front. So it is good to see policymakers really aligned with the goal of the developing the industry and our capabilities. Like Canada, for instance, like we're a tier one nation. Like we do everything except enrichment. We have some of the most robust uranium mines in the world. Like we could probably support the entire global fleet from just Canada if the will was there and if the need was there. But there's plenty of other deposits around the world that are accessible throughout Africa, throughout Southeast Asia, throughout South America. Just Canada just happens to have some of the highest grade ore deposits available to us, so we take advantage of that. And yeah, we still have plenty more to be tapped into when the time comes and when it's needed. And if anybody's paying attention to uranium spot markets right now, like holy shit, it went from like 60 to almost 75 in just a few days, which is a quite a green candle for uranium that many people were expecting to come and predicting to come for some time if you pay attention to that space. But then one day it just hits you out of nowhere, and everyone's just like, what do we do now? Because it's showing that there's a lot of demand for uranium, but everyone was just lulled into this like essentially a crab market in the uranium markets, because nothing really exciting was happening. But now we're starting to see a lot more movement with reestablishing fuel channels and fuel lines and really developing the domestic infrastructure in places like Canada and North America, where it had been neglected for a while. Like Canada, not so bad, because we've started refurbishing our reactor fleet in the early 2010s, and then we went through the trials and tribulations of doing the first few and learned some lessons, and now we're applying that to the continuing refurbishment of the entire fleet. I think there's 10 altogether between Bruce and Darlington. Pickering is possibly on the table for a full refurbishment, and even Gentilly 2 in Quebec is a question mark at this point. But they've taken what they've learned, and now they're essentially rebuilding all of the fuel channels in the reactors and replacing the guts. And they're doing it on schedule and ahead of budget. So they're doing an amazing job at keeping Canada's like nuclear capabilities and manufacturing capabilities at top notch, because then we want to parlay that into like, if we're already building the components to swap out of our existing CANDU reactor fleet, like why can't we parlay that into building more CANDU reactors? And I believe that's part of this investment in the Romanian CANDU reactors, because that will give an opportunity for like they will be buying a lot of the material and supplies from the Canadian supply chain, which will reinvigorate our supply chain, reinvigorate our labor chains, and also on their front, because that was one of the biggest obstacles to overcome building to like these new reactor projects, like the one in Norway, the one in Great Britain right now, and the one in Georgia, was because these places had, although they have nuclear industries and they have had for some time, having not built a new reactor for almost three decades, puts a significant strain on your supply chains and your labor force. It's like, if you do not maintain the capabilities to build this level of infrastructure, it is just going to vanish on you. And then you have to completely reconstitute it many decades later when you finally want to go ahead and do it. And because it's a very like knowledge intensive technology, having lost a lot of the like the intellectual capacity of these giants that started this industry decades ago, and then they didn't have as much opportunity as they should have to pass on that knowledge to the next generation, is a huge loss to the industry and to humanity as a whole. Because like there's so many examples of that. Like I had heard someone was telling a story about, they were asking their father about architecture, and like there was, it was like a 17th century architecture. And they were asking like what would it take for us to rebuild something like that? And the response was like, we can't, we don't know how. We lost the capabilities. We lost the understanding of how to build things with that level of intricacy. So it's very important if we want to sustain and like an industry with at this, that is at this scale and of this importance to humanity, like we have to maintain the like the human capital to be able to keep it operational. So, and that's one of the things that's really invigorated right now. So we're seeing a lot more enthusiasm from the younger generation for nuclear power, and the industry is really capitalizing on that and generating a lot more pathways to bring them into the industry and develop them. Because even outside of like nuclear engineer, like that's only one pathway. The nuclear industry, basically any trade that you can think of, whether you're into like chemistry, whether you're into like complex mathematical modeling, like there is any number of like jobs and careers that you can find in the nuclear industry. And it's very, very, very well paid and very reliable. Like you can spend entire careers here. Like there's people that I'm aware of that their great grandfather started on the construction of one of these reactors, that they're now a part of like the decommissioning, and they had multiple generations working for the reactor during its operation. So like there's a lot of cool stories like that out there that really connect communities around this type of infrastructure.
Yeah, and it's great stuff. And you definitely, you know, kind of highlighted a lot of the younger generation getting interested in nuclear. And I mean, I think that's, you know, everybody kind of realizing like, hey, there's another solution for a lot of these energy issues. But you know, the younger generation's also getting interested in things like Bitcoin. And we've gone 36 minutes here. We haven't even talked about where Bitcoin plays in all of this, in this scenario and the growing, like, you know, energy concerns. So I'll leave it broad right here. Like, where do you think, I guess, Bitcoin and Bitcoin mining kind of plays into this role, whether it's, you know, kind of integrating with nuclear, balancing the grid, all that great stuff. Like, where do you think Bitcoin plays in this ever-changing, I guess, energy landscape that we've got here?
Yeah, in my opinion, I believe that Bitcoin is the perfect, like Bitcoin mining is the perfect anchor technology and load to collaborate and integrate with like a nuclear power generation, because we can match it perfectly to any supply and demand profile. You want to build 50 megawatts of nuclear power in this remote community that only needs 30 megawatts. Well, you're going to have to find something to fill in that extra 20 megawatts and to ensure that it's not being completely stranded and curtailed. And you want to maximize the utility of your generation station. So you bring a consumer with you. And as we know in the Bitcoin space, like there are very few consumers of electricity that can compare to the profile that Bitcoin miners offer with the scalability and modularity of between like a single computer to a rack of computers to a warehouse full of computers. We can go from kilowatts to megawatts to gigawatts. So it's like some of these projects that I'm hearing about coming being built right now are massive. Like a few hundred megawatt data center is huge, but now we're talking gigawatts with what Riot's doing and what Justin Orkney at Standard Power, he's building something in Ohio right now that's going to be very impressive when it comes online. And I can't wait to see it, because it's going to be directly related to nuclear power. But yeah, like it's just that anchor load is an important feature for building power generation, because when you look into why many power generation projects are like planned and never completed, they'll often cite uncertainty of demand or fluctuating markets or a change in politics or that there was too much like activism opposition. Those are like the four primary reasons where you'll find like these projects being shut down. But the ones related to demand, like those are now easy to solve. Like right now there's a lot of interest in collaborating technologies like hydrogen generation, desalination, creating higher order chemicals, doing pharmaceuticals. Most people probably saw the other day that Microsoft is looking into using small modular reactors to support a lot of their high intensive data center needs. So that's an interesting development. That one's interesting because like they have a different profile to the Bitcoin miners, and they require like the full uptime, which is great for a nuclear power station to have a load that's always on and always available. But they don't tolerate curtailment as much, which is another really unique profile to the Bitcoin miners. Although you're not going to be earning profit when you turn off your load, if you're being compensated for doing that with grid programs like the demand response and ancillary programs that like a grid like ERCOT has, they will pay a consumer to be available to curtail their load for a very narrow window of the day. Like, and when it's only a few hours for a few days at like the hottest peak of the year or at the coldest peak of the year, like they're only putting these miners at a capacity factor of like 95%. So they may not be getting 100% uptime, but they're still operating almost 100% of the time. And then for that 5% of the time that they're not operating, they're getting paid significantly more than they would be to be mining Bitcoin. Like as we saw, if you have a power contract for 5 cents a kilowatt hour and the spot price goes up to like $5 a kilowatt hour, like you would be stupid to be using that electricity to mine Bitcoin when you can just sell it back to the grid at the spot price. So it's interesting that the miners have now opened up an alternate avenue to sell electricity to that's like a digital conduit so that we can arbitrage electricity from anywhere to anywhere. Whereas like with the hydrogen and the desalination and a lot of these other industrial applications that we typically would employ where we have very cheap electricity, like say like aluminum smelting in Iceland, like the idea is that you're arbitraging the cost of that cheap electricity by creating a higher value added product where it's cheap and then selling that in markets where it's more expensive, and then you basically pocket the difference. But now we have a technology to do that without any physical transportation and storage constraints. Like you can mine Bitcoin in a mine right now in Kenya. You can cash out into a wallet on your phone, and you can in theory spend that at a bar in El Salvador like within minutes. Like that is crazy impressive, and it's only going to get easier and easier to do it as more Lightning functionality rolls out and more capabilities on that front. And then we're starting to see other things like ways to pay for electricity. Like I don't know if you're familiar with the company Sunoda that's trying to develop a software that's going to enable the capability to pay for your utilities in real time. So like we, in theory, that can be electricity, your natural gas, your internet, labor. Like there's any number of things that we can start tinkering around with that. But then that starts opening up multiple pathways for these energy generators to start obtaining Bitcoin on aside from just mining the Bitcoin. And then once they have it, then you start asking questions like, well, what do you do once you have Bitcoin on your balance sheet as a power generator? Do you just turn it around and sell it for whatever local currency you need, and then you can just purchase whatever goods and services you require to sustain your operation or do infrastructure development in your local community and whatnot? Or do you keep it as Bitcoin on your treasury? Do you use it to like open up Lightning channels? Do you create like a Fediment within your like local community? Can you create like mints within like your companies just themselves? The way that it's being described that these technologies can be used, like they start seeing the ways that they can layer into each other. And then it's going to open up a lot more capabilities for these communities where we deploy these reactors to engage in like global commerce by having first the access to the electricity, and then that enables them all the second order effects of, like, once you've got electricity, then you can get good, reliable water resources, then you get good education, good health services, and then everything kind of just builds around having that reliable energy. But to have that reliable energy in the first place, you need that anchor load in order to justify the economics of building the power in the first place. Like, that is why I really like the business model of a company like Gridless, where they'll go and find small potential hydro operations where it's 70, 80 kilowatts, but the community is only using 30 kilowatts on average, and then they'll peak up to 50 to 60 megawatt or kilowatts, and then you can just place a few computers in that space and hold the space, and then as the community grows, they can just displace those computers to somewhere else, or they can invest in increasing their electricity capacity. So I can see us doing basically the exact same thing with SMRs, just at a much larger scale in the megawatts to hundreds of megawatts range. And then because of the modularity of these reactors, we can just add more modules of power, or we can take away the mining load and redistribute that elsewhere, like, because we have now seen things like the Luxor has a really good ASIC marketplace, they're also hash rate, because Blockware Intelligence has a good one, like there's Kaboom Racks, there's a whole bunch of like really good trustworthy marketplaces that are starting to pop up around the space in order to resell your hardware. So it's going to give these energy generators a lot more optionality with what to do with their electricity once they have this extra load coupled with their generators. So we can strategically build excess generation in the present with the expectation of a community building and growing into that excess capacity sometime in the future. But beforehand, like, yeah, leaving that electricity stranded was a huge economic liability. But now we have something that we can use as a placeholder in the form of Bitcoin miners, that we don't have to worry about, like, storing any hydrogen or storing any, like, desalinated water. And, like, unless we're able to use that stuff immediately in the local market where it's being produced, I don't see it having that much value. Like, if you're going to have to transport it over long distances, you're going to lose a lot of the value add of creating the hydrogen in the first place. So unless you're doing it somewhere like a port, like that's one of the things that they want to do in New Brunswick when they want to upgrade some of their nuclear infrastructure, is they actually have a CANDU reactor out there as well, and they want to build some new ones, and they want to take one of their ports and completely gut out all of the coal, replace it with all nuclear, and turn it into a large clean energy industrial park where they'll export hydrogen and other chemicals and fertilizers, they'll do water desalination, and then they'll also have the manufacturing plant that builds that reactor there and at the port, so it'll be quick to put on a ship and then export it to various other markets once it's been fully matured and prepared for that level of showtime.
Yeah, and that's all great stuff. And, you know, obviously there's a lot of innovation going on in the Bitcoin space. You named a bunch of companies, but before I let you go, I want to see if you can highlight, I guess, maybe either one project, one company that you think is, like, really, you know, I guess, revolutionizing, whether it's Bitcoin mining or payments or something that gets you jacked up about the Bitcoin space as we're going forward. And, you know, coming up on this next halving period, right? I think that's going to be a big time for the Bitcoin miners, and, you know, maybe some innovation there on the energy front of things can definitely help with some of the strain that some of these miners might face in the next, 6 to 8 months or so. What's a project that you're really bullish on going forward?
Like, I'm loving seeing all the development in the mining space between the number of companies that have really shown the capabilities to have, like, really robust risk management strategies and kind of weathering the weird last 2 years that we went through. Like, this is only my first full cycle, but, like, it does seem like this one has been exceptionally tough on miners. So it's really cool to see all of the different strategies that are being employed, whether it's to do the PubCo strategy and have the financial support that way and to build themselves out, or to the more, like, lean way, like where like CleanSpark is is more, they're more risk averse to taking on debt and trying to build slow and steady. It's sort of seeing like different tortoise and hare strategies. And then as Bob Burnett likes to point out, like the different, the hares and the horses and the elephant strategies with like the different scales of the mining operations that are coming into to fruition, and the different trade-offs that they have, whether you're operating something that's like a big fixed system, whereas you're compared to something that's more modular and portable. It's compared to just the pleb miners at home that are intentionally mining at a loss because they know they're getting KYC free Bitcoin, and they're also doing clever things with the heat, with their greenhouses and their water tanks and their subfloor heating and all the crazy kooky engineering schemes that we're seeing miners come up with. Like I really want to see more of the heating side of mining become more approachable to like the average like layman. Like something like an off-the-shelf system, like what CryptoCloaks has, where I've downloaded the parts and I haven't fully assembled it yet. That's winter's coming, so I've got a few weeks to get that together. But I want to put together my own like little CryptoCloaks S9 like heater that's wife approved, so that it'll mitigate the sound and still keep the house warm, where we would have already been using a space heater to begin with. So we might as well be using an S9. So I don't really care that I'm mining at a loss because I'm using it for heat and I'm also getting Bitcoin out of it. And if I'm not selling that Bitcoin immediately, I'm only selling it at a loss if I'm selling it at the current price I'm mining it at relative to the current price of Bitcoin. If I hold on to it for 2, 3, 4 years, like that, then technically what I mined at my current price of electricity, I'm selling at 100,000 per Bitcoin. So who knows that what that could look like. It is definitely a risky game to play if when you're buying Bitcoin with your electricity bill, if you're definitely doing it at a loss. Like I play the game in Ontario, we have time of use pricing. So I try to make sure that it's turned off during the day as much as possible so I'm not paying 18 cents a kilowatt hour for it. And then the other thing I do is I have two pumped into my dryer because I blew out the heating element. So I had several S9s lying around, so I pumped them into the dryer. So like, I want to see more of this. And I think that we will, now that we're kind of seeing companies, I think Dorsey's company, what is it, Circle now or Spiral? I forget what the heck it's called now.
It is Spiral. But
yeah, they want to create a sort of ASIC that has more modular applications that can be put into more than just like the conventional like shoebox that we're familiar with. So I wouldn't be surprised if in the not too distant future, things have developed in this space with ASIC chips that wherever you find a resistance coil heater, it'll start being slowly replaced by ASIC chips, and your kettle will now be mining Bitcoin, and your hot water tank will now be mining Bitcoin. And these will just be standard things that are just off the shelf products that we start using. And it's probably going to be many years before we get there, but we're seeing the infancy of those developments coming now, and especially in colder climates. Like if you can supplement your heat, why not?
Yeah, and I mean that's great stuff. So I'm down here in Florida, and I'm looking to I don't know. Long story short, I have two water heaters because I have a duplex, and I'm trying to remove one water heater and use an S9. So if anybody wants to come down to Tampa and help me out with that project, I'd be more than happy to be a guinea pig for that and kind of move that going forward. But I agree with you. I think that the innovation as far as like the heat aspect of things hasn't really been tapped in yet. So I'm really excited to see where that goes going forward. But you've been very generous with your time coming on here and talking a bunch about, the future of nuclear and Bitcoin mining. So, it was a great conversation. And I want to shoot over people to your stuff. And so figure out what you're doing, what you got going on. So why don't you tell the people where they can find you and what all you got going on?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brandon. Like, it's a very optimistic time these days, considering how the last few years have played out. It's gotten a lot of people out of their funk, finding Bitcoin and finding nuclear power and finding something to be optimistic about for the future. But like, yeah, as for myself, on Twitter, it's Nuclear Bitcoiner. On Noster, it's Nuclear Bitcoiner. And on Orange Pill app, it's also Nuclear Bitcoiner. Those are the three primary messaging applications where I'm trying to communicate with the plebs and trying to shift more to Noster. But but none of the energy talk is going on Nostr yet, so I still have to stick to Twitter to get my fix on that stuff. But we'll gradually start dragging some of them over to the other side. We just need to start getting them hooked on Zaps.
Yeah, man, we need to get Zaps on somehow on an app on the App Store. Unfortunately, Apple kind of coming at Domus now. I mean, I don't know. We'll see how that all plays out. I'm sure we'll figure it out. Oh, you know,
you need a sly roundabout way.
Yeah, I know. I think there is like a sly around way, but I don't know. I couldn't figure it out. But
anyway. I think you have to go to the profile and then you can actually like zap the profile. You can't zap individual posts or something. That was like the compromise they had to make, which is annoying because it is nice when you're just flicking through. You're just like, oh, I like that image. I like that comment.
Yeah. And I mean, it's, you know, as normally with these kind of things, the less resistance when it comes to these things, the more times people would use that sort of thing. So I don't know. I feel like it's all, I don't know, semantics at this point. But Ryan, thanks so much for coming on. And yeah, I'll put everything that you said in the show notes as well. And yeah, everybody go check him out. So yeah, Ryan, thanks so much, man.
Yeah, thanks for having me.